Hi, this is Susie Larson, and thank you so much for listening to Live the Promise today. Our website is filled with even more powerful and encouraging interviews. Learn more by logging on to myfaithradio.com. Let that song linger, because I love that little part where he says, there are days when I lose the battle, but grace says that it doesn't matter because the cross has already won the war. I'm learning to run freely, understanding just how he sees me, and it makes me love him more and more. That about sums it up, don't you think? Thanks for tuning in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Hour 2 of Live the Promise. If you just tuned in, you missed my first hour conversation with Woman of Faith speaker Patsy Claremont. What a darling, dear woman she is, talking about anxiety and fear and how Jesus met her in those deepest places and walked her through the valley. Well, now we have one of our favorite friends, Tullian Trevigen, joining us. And I'm telling you, nobody talks about grace like him and his friend Elise Fitzpatrick. Those two can knock it out of the park as far as I'm concerned. I don't want to waste another minute, because we just tend to be grace forgetters, you know, and we got to really revisit what it means when Jesus says it is finished, because he meant that for us. So don't let me waste another minute. I want to get to this, introduce you to our guest, and we'll get him on the show. Tullian Trevigen, William Graham Tullian Trevigen, is the senior pastor of Coral Ridge Presbyterian Church in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and the grandson of Billy and Ruth Graham. He's an ordained minister, Presbyterian Church of America. His books include One Way Love, Jesus Plus Nothing Equals Everything, and Glorious Ruin. You can find his influencer page at our website at mindfaithradio.com. Tullian, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back, Susie. As I told you off the air a minute ago, I absolutely love coming on your show. You are an amazingly gracious host, a great interviewer, and you like to talk about the stuff that I like to talk about.
Wow.
So thanks for having me back.
That means so much, really, coming from you, really does. And you know the drill, you've been on enough times. We love to open up just talking scripture and wondering if there's just a verse that you've been pondering or thinking about these days.
Well, I think I mentioned this on the program last time I was on. It's very, very difficult for me to get away from Romans 8, what I call the Great Eight chapter in the Bible, beginning with Romans 8:1, where Paul makes this amazing declaration that there is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And then he closes that chapter by reminding us that there is absolutely nothing that can separate us from God's love, because God's love for us is ultimately dependent not on what we do or fail to do, but God's love for us is dependent on what Jesus has done for us, so that if we are Christians, we live our lives under a banner that reads, it is finished. And that means that all of the approval and all of the love and all of the significance and all of the meaning that we crave, that we long for, that we live for, and that we look for in things infinitely smaller than Jesus are already ours in Christ. Oh. And that's just a complete game changer as far as I'm concerned. At least it's changed the game of my life.
Wow.
And I'm incredibly grateful for it.
It's, you know, if that doesn't make you want to break out in a happy dance, I don't know what does, you know. And, you know, I often say that we are grace forgetters and Sabbath neglectors, and yet I feel like these are the two things that bring rest and freedom to our soul. And I want you just to talk for a minute about how the power of grace and the permission to rest, and I'm using Sabbath in a more broad term, just moments, not only practicing downtime, but having an ebb to our flow, that we, because we have nothing to prove and all eternity to live for, we have permission to rest. And I think that rest is an act of faith as much as service is. So I want you to talk about how the power of grace and the permission to rest has impacted your life and service, Tullian.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus issued this amazing invitation to all weary and heavy laden people that if we go to him, we will find rest. He didn't say, come to me, all of you self-sufficient good people, and I will give you a to-do list that will impress me and my Father. He said, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And I think the church should be the one institution in all of society where weary and heavy laden people can come and find rest, can hear good news. And all too often what I've found is that weary and heavy laden people come to church and what they get instead of rest is a to-do list. They get a do more, try harder, get better, or else version of the Christian faith. And they don't leave relaxed and rested and reassured. They don't leave liberated and set free and unburdened. Actually, they leave more burdened coming or leaving church than they did coming. And so I'm absolutely convinced and passionate about the Christian life being defined by rest. And when we talk about rest, we're not saying the Christian life is defined by a lack of activity.
Right, or the couch of ease, even, right? But a heart
right.
at rest, yeah.
Right, exactly. It's not, we're not taught, rest is not laying on the couch and doing nothing with your life. That's actually self-service. That's mm-hmm. not real rest. And the rest that Jesus is talking about is the rest that comes along with knowing that I already have the meaning and the acceptance and the love that I look for in my relationships, in my work, in my hobbies, in all of these other things. I already have that stuff. So now I am actually free to love and to give without needing love and something in return. Mm. And that's actual rest, because what makes us exhausted in life is not anything outside of us, difficult job or difficult kids or trying relationships. That's not the root cause of our exhaustion. The root cause of our exhaustion is inside of us. It's this pressing need to justify ourselves by what we do, by what we can produce, by what we can become. And Jesus says, I've taken care of all of that for you. Mm. But you don't need anything in addition to what I have already given to you for free. So now you're actually free to enjoy your children without needing the raising of good children to save your life. Now you can actually wow. enjoy your family and enjoy your work without needing your work to save you and justify your existence and validate you. That's real rest.
Wow, that is so powerful. Well, let's play that forward a little bit, the do more and try harder message. If that's consistently coming forth, which it is, I think, in a lot of scenarios, play it forward and talk about the impact and ripple effect of that message. For one, it's not sustainable. Two, I'm answering my own question here, doesn't bear fruit. But I want you to just talk about the problem with that.
Yeah, you're right. It's not sustainable. I mean, one of two things happens when people are getting a steady diet of do more, try harder sermons. The honest people will quickly realize they can't pull it off, and so they quit. The honest people actually walk away, and they quit, and they conclude that the Christian faith is not for me, because the Christian faith is clearly for good people. The Christian faith is clearly for strong people, and I don't feel good or strong, so it's not for me. So the honest people quit. The dishonest people actually begin to believe that they're pulling it off. They have to actually convince themselves that they are pulling it off, when in fact, they're really not pulling it off. So you either have despair produced on the one hand or self-righteousness produced on the other hand. So no good fruit, as you said, comes from preaching a do more, try harder, get better or else kind of sermon, or reading a do more, try harder, get better or else kind of a book. No fruit actually comes from that. And I think we've talked about this before, but I don't want to get too theological here, but I think this really stems from a failure to understand the distinction between God's law and God's gospel. Both are good. Both come from God. And we need to hear both God's law and God's gospel. But they have two very different job descriptions. The law may show us what love looks like, but the law in and of itself cannot produce love. Even Jesus's command to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself We need to hear that. But that command in itself doesn't produce what it demands. The love that is commanded by the law is only produced by love. First John tells us that. You know, we love him because he first loved us. So just telling people what to do doesn't have the power to inspire them to do it. And the way I explain this to people, just on a horizontal level, is look at your relationships. I mean, I can't think of one person in the history of humanity that has ever fallen in love with anybody who looks at them and says, love me.
Yeah.
I deserve it. We fall in love with people who look at us when we least deserve it and say, I love you. Mm-hmm. It's love, not law, that produces love. And so I think the whole premise of do more, try harder, get better, or else sermons is that preachers and writers and Christian leaders want to see their people loving God and loving others. But what they concluded, I think, is that just telling them they need to do it will actually empower them to do it. And that's trusting in the law to do what only the gospel can do.
Mm. Wow, so well put. And you think about any external pressure that others put on us or that we put on ourselves, as you said, produces pride or despair. We either get puffed up because we think we're doing well until we measure ourselves against someone else, or we fall apart and we can't do it. But when you think about abiding in the vine, where we're much with God, and we do what he gives us to do because we're living for him, we're not pleasing man anymore, in doing that, that's where the fruit is. And we actually end up nourishing many. But it's from a place that is sustainable and life-giving, not only for us and others. I mean, that's the miracle of abiding, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, too, and I was thinking about this maybe 20 minutes ago as I was upstairs doing some writing. I was thinking about, just how hard it is for us to hear commands and demands and things that we know we ought to do, and we find ourselves at the end of ourselves not really being able to pull it off, at least not being able to pull off the perfection that God requires. And I think a lot of Christians think that if they're not demonstrating self-sufficiency and strength and cleanliness, if they're not demonstrating a complete put-togetherness, that they're going to hurt their witness. I've heard that so many mm-hmm. times. And at least in my experience, I've been pastoring now for close to 20 years, and in my experience, what I've discovered is that non-Christians are much more attracted to desperate people who are honest and who say, I am just as messed up as you are, probably more so. I'm just as needy as you are, probably more so. I'm just as weak as you are and just as afraid as you are, probably more so. That's when non-Christian people tune in. They're not impressed with our strength. I mean, they don't. I've said this to our people at Coral Ridge before. The world desperately needs to hear our confession of need, not to see our competence. Mm. Competence is not impressive. In fact, it kind of puts them on the defense and makes them think that they have to show they're competent too. When you sort of come to people and say, I am just a beggar showing other beggars where to find bread, I have discovered that they typically listen to that. They're just not captivated by how smart we are, how big we are, how strong we are, how powerful we are, how influential we are. They're not impressed by that. In fact, that really puts them off. But when we're honest and say, I'm scared that my kids aren't going to turn out the way I hope they will, just like you. I'm afraid that I'm not going to have the financial security when I'm in my 60s and 70s that I want, just like you. I have secrets that I don't want anybody to find out, and I'm deathly afraid that they will, just like you. The message of the gospel is not for non-Christians, and it's not for Christians, it's for humans. Mm. And Christians and non-Christians share the same longings and the same needs, and they share the same weakness because we are broken people living in a broken world with other broken people. And if we can be honest about that and show that we are needy too, that's when I found that they actually pay attention to what we say.
Hear what Tullian just said. The world desperately needs to see our confession of need, not our amazing competence. Here's a question for you, unless you've got one for Tullian. Do you sense that you're attached to other people's opinions of you? Is your attachment to your kids that they need to make you look good? Your vocation needs to make you look good? Your pastor, you need his approval, so you're striving like crazy? I'd love to hear from you. You can call anonymously as well. We want to stand with you and really help you get free today, if that's possible. 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. Call with your questions as well, or email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Don't go away. More with Tully and Chavijan in a moment. Glad you tuned in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to my friend Tullian Chavijan. He's got a number of fantastic books, and I'll tell you, one of his books, I think it was One Way, I think that was the one, just transformed my daughter-in-law's life. She listened to us talking one day, she grabbed onto it, and we had conversations, and she said this was brand new information to her, and she'd been a Christian her whole life. And this one we're looking at today is It Is Finished, 365 Days of Good News. I don't know if we have a couple of copies on hand, but I know people, so I think I might be able to get one. If you got a question, comment, 877-933-2484. So, Tullian, I know you, in your backstory, you went through a time of striving and burnout. And I think that's why you're so passionate, because you know it's not sustainable and it actually does more harm than good. So if you don't mind, take us back to that time, what your thought process was and what that striving time and burnout was like for you.
Yeah, I mean, I was privileged enough to grow up in a Christian home. God gave me a remarkable Christian heritage. I'm the middle of seven children. My mom and dad loved us all well. As far back as I can remember, I believed in God. My parents taught us the importance of praying. I understood the biblical categories of sin, grace, and that sort of stuff. And they really raised us in an atmosphere of fun, and it was hospitable, and it wasn't legalistic at all. It was enjoyable. But at about 14 or 15 years old, I started to go off the rails, and it got so bad by the time I reached 16 that I ended up dropping out of high school, and my parents basically had to come to me and say, listen, we love you, but if you're going to continue living this way, you can't live this way under our roof. So at 16 years old, they did the unthinkable. They kicked me out of the house. And at this point, I thought this was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. No teachers breathing down my neck, no parents looking over my shoulder. I was finally free to pursue whatever I wanted to pursue and do whatever I wanted to do. And the Bible says that sin is pleasurable for a season, but when that season comes to an end, you're left with a gaping hole in your soul that only God is big enough to fill. And that season came to an end for me at 21 years old. It wasn't the result of a particular circumstance or a particular crisis. It was just this culminating sense of there's got to be more to who I am than what this world was telling me. And so I began a relationship with God in a brand new, bright, and liberating way. And for the first 6 months of my Christian life, I could not sing about grace, talk about grace, or hear sermons about grace without weeping. I was so acutely aware of how bad I was. And I couldn't believe that God would love me, that God would rescue me, that God would come after me and pursue me and save me. I was just so flabbergasted by the unconditional nature of God's love, really his one-way love to me. But about 6 to 12 months into my newfound Christian life, there was a shift that took place, and I think this is very common for people, especially people who were doing bad stuff, and now they stop doing bad stuff and they start doing good stuff. The shift for me that took place was it stopped primarily being all about what Jesus had done, and it started to become primarily about what I must do. And I lost sense of my own desperation. Mm. I stopped thinking that I was as desperate as I was before God rescued me. And I started to believe my own press, that I was actually getting better and stronger and more self-sufficient and that sort of thing. And even though I never heard a sermon like this growing up, there were many sermons I heard that at least left the impression that you need Jesus a lot at the beginning of your Christian life. But as you grow as a Christian, you begin needing him less and less because you're getting stronger and stronger and more competent. And so Christian growth was kind of presented as this, I'm getting stronger and stronger and more competent each and every day, instead of the way the Bible actually describes Christian growth, which is I'm becoming increasingly aware of how weak and incompetent I am and how strong and competent Jesus continues to be for me. And so I, not only started living my Christian life this way, but I went to college and then I went to seminary and I started pastoring a church and I started preaching sermons. And I really thought that I was a pretty good guy, that I was pretty strong, that I had it all together, that I was nothing like I used to be back in the day. And then in 2009, the church that I had planted merged with Coral Ridge Presbyterian Church, and that process was debilitating to me. It was incredibly difficult. It was very, very painful. For the first time in my life, I really felt like I was at the end of my rope, like I was ready to walk away from ministry altogether. And God really, really brought me to the end. He broke my legs and reminded me of just how desperate and needy I was. And I was reading through Colossians chapter 1 one morning, and in those verses, especially 12 through 14, Paul says, you've already been transferred, you've already been forgiven, you've already been qualified. This is a done deal. And so all of the approval and all of the acceptance and all of the meaning and all of the validity and all of the love that you're looking for in other people, I've already given to you. And so that gave me fresh insight into what I call the now power of the gospel. Mm. And I used to think that the gospel was for non-Christians only. It was for people outside the church. But the fact of the matter is that the gospel is just as necessary for Christians as it is for non-Christians. As you said earlier in the show, we need to preach the gospel to ourselves every day because we forget it every day.
Yeah.
And we're constantly drifting toward our own self-sufficiency and our own sense of strength and those sorts of things. And the worst thing that can ever happen to a Christian, the absolute worst thing that can ever happen to a Christian, is to lose a sense of our own desperation. Because when we do that, grace ceases to be amazing to us. It's sort of like, yeah, grace, yeah. Okay, let's get on to talk about the real stuff. Like, what do you want me to do? What should I sacrifice? It reminds me of John chapter 6 when Jesus' disciples say to Jesus, what must we be doing to be doing the works of God? And it's almost like they ask the question, then they get out their, pads of paper and their pens, and they're serious Christians, so they're going to write down everything he says, and then they're going to go out and do everything he says. And Jesus responds by saying, the work of God is to believe in the one in whom he sent. That's it. So anticlimactic.
So good. Talking to Tully and Javidge, we got more to talk about on grace and the idea, the fact, the truth, that it is finished. Do you know what that means? More with Tully when we come back. He's on our side. You believe that? I'm so glad you tuned in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to one of our favorites, Tully and Chavijan, about what Jesus meant when he said, it is finished. And Tully, when I was writing my book, Your Beautiful Purpose, just, and it's kind of about the two things that I think get in the way of a woman's heart from walking out God's purposes, self-ambition and self-preservation. We either get ahead in impatience or fall behind because we get so full of fear. But as I was prepping and writing that book, I was looking at when the disciples came back to Jesus and said, Lord, Lord, even the demons obey. And you'd think, Talian, that Jesus would have jumped on that, because if you look at him, he seemed to stop in his tracks when he saw faith. You know, it's like he would marvel at unbelief and he would marvel at faith, but not much else seemed to really make him go, wow, you know, did you see that just now? So you would expect that he would go, see, I told you this faith stuff worked. And so I was sort of surprised in that mindset as I was kind of reading through that. And he said, you know, don't marvel that the demons obey you. In other words, I already told you that I'm going to give you power, but marvel that your name is written in the book of life. And that stopped me in my tracks. So I started to think, you know, if the wonder of what we get to do upstages what he's already done, we've already lost our way. And I think that goes back to what you're saying. If grace sees us to be amazing, and if we don't wake up every day going, my name, you know, I once was, and now I am. My name is in the book of life. If we don't start to continually unpack that, we will be more in awe of what we get to do, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I think that, and this is, I was kind of shocked to discover how many people who had grown up in church didn't realize that the gospel was just as important for Christians as it is for non-Christians. The gospel for people who grew up in church, for the most part, was synonymous with evangelism only. That was what it was for me, too. And I was telling a group of people in St. Louis this a couple weeks ago, to give you a bird's eye view of the state of evangelicalism, I told them this story. I said, I grew up in a Christian home. I went to Christian schools. I went to church every Sunday. I went to a Christian college. I went to a seminary and got a graduate degree in theology and Bible. I graduated from seminary and planted a church and was, you know, ordained in a denomination and was preaching every single week and doing so for roughly 3 years before I realized, before it dawned on me, that the gospel was just as much for Christians as it is for non-Christians, that I needed the gospel just as much today as I did the day I was saved. And I'm asking, so I'm thinking this out loud and going, what in the world was I hearing or not hearing in all of those Christian contexts, those conservative, Bible-believing Christian contexts that led me to believe that once God saves you, he moves you beyond the gospel so that once you're a Christian, you don't need it anymore. And I think it's an absolutely crucial discovery. And it's nothing new. I mean, this is just stuff that Martin Luther and the Protestant reformers were championing, and Augustine before him were championing, you know, long, long, long ago. But this idea that the gospel is just as much for Christians as it is for non-Christians, and just as necessary for Christians as it is for non-Christians, seems so new and novel to so many people. And I think that shows just how far we've drifted.
Wow.
And so I, like you, am hoping and praying really for a new kind of reformation. Next year we will celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, where God turned the world and the church upside down by basically recovering the message of grace alone. And I hope we see that at some point, because I talked to lots and lots of people inside and outside the church who are just weary, heavy laden, and burdened, and the church is not doing anything or saying anything to remove those burdens. They're not hearing it is finished. They're hearing just do it, but they're not hearing it is finished.
Well, let's talk about this in very practical terms. So, you know, my hubby and I, we both work big full-time jobs, and then we're on the road 2 weekends a month in the fall and the spring, and then I write in the summer, but I'm working full time, then I write on the weekends. And so we're both managing a lot. And so when we first came to our church, we have a great church, our pastor said, I know what you do outside the walls of these church walls, and I want to give you full permission. If what you need here is rest, come and rest. If you want to get plugged in, I'll get you plugged in, but don't feel under any obligation from me, because I know that you guys have a full time ministry in addition to your full time jobs. I almost cried. I just couldn't believe it. But we host a once a month cell life group, and for people who minister outside the walls of the church, all these people who've been at this church for 10 and 20 years have said, nobody knows me here, and I feel so disconnected. And sometimes you feel substandard because you're not there half the time because you're on the road, you know, I mean, on prayer ministry teams, we pray in front and people come down to the front. And then I speak, you know, for free a few different times throughout the year. And would you believe it, though? I still get this niggling kind of ought to, should do thing that, you know, other people are at church so much more. My pastor has said that, but my, even God has told me, you know, I've got it down as far as I know what burns me out and what is sustainable for me. But I still deal with that little bit of, ugh. And I have to put it under my feet. It's nothing like it used to be. But do you deal with any of that? Or are you just so feisty that it just doesn't occur to you anymore to care what people think?
No.
Do you know what I'm saying?
I don't think I'm any different than the rest of the human race in the sense that ever since Genesis chapter 3, every single one of us have been addicted to self-salvation projects. Mm-hmm. And by that, what I mean is not, you know, we think that our good works at the end of the day will outweigh our bad works and God will let us into heaven. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the variety of different ways that we in our lives try to secure for ourselves love and meaning and significance and worth and value and acceptance and approval. I mean, most of what we do and most of what we pursue is driven by the need to justify ourselves, this longing to justify ourselves, which is why I've told people on numerous occasions, we may not believe in justification by works theologically, but every single one of us believes in justification by works functionally.
Wow.
And that absolutely exhausts us.
Yes.
It exhausts us. So as my friend David Zoll said a few weeks ago when he was speaking at our conference down here at Liberate, you know, he said, listen, we hear the pushback on message. We hear the pushback. Like, you can't just tell people it is finished. You got to tell them what to go out and do. And David's like, I don't think the primary problem in our society today is a lack of activity. In fact, people inside and outside the church are running around ragged trying to figure out how to justify themselves, how to validate themselves. We do it inside the church. We do it outside the church. What we need to hear more than anything are Jesus' three beautifully liberating words, it is finished. And what I've discovered is that when that message of it is finished gets down deep into the heart of people, it doesn't make them do less. It actually inspires them to do more.
Yes, true.
And now they're doing those things not because they need to get anything in return. They're doing those things out of just love for God and love for others. It's the difference between living our lives for approval and living our lives from approval.
Indeed.
Living our lives for love rather than, or, you know, living our lives from love. It's a huge difference, and one equals freedom and one equals slavery.
Oh, that's so true. And because I'm a strategic thinker, that's all God has to do is to say, did I invite you to that? Did I ask you to do that? Because
right.
I asked you to do this thing this weekend, and you're going to need your strength for it. So this yes requires these no's. And then it gives me, you know, but that is the battle for me. It's not significant like it used to be, but I buck up against it every once in a while, and I can see where that driving has come from. Driving is coming from, and the reason I think it's important we look at it that close up, Talene, is because you think of if every single person is squandering really their sacred time because of other people's opinions, what's really not getting done where that would come out of that abiding place that would bear fruit? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I think, too, when we think about the life that God has called us to live, the life that God has invited us to live, it's a life of service to our neighbor, loving our neighbor. And the only way that is made possible is if the gospel grips us in such a deep way that we realize, thanks to what Jesus has done for me, I now have everything that I need. So I can give everything to you without needing anything from you in return. That's love, and that's sacrificial service, and that can only happen if we believe that everything we need in Christ we already possess. So now my relationship with you is not defined by what I can extract from you to make me feel like I matter. What my relationship with you is now defined by, I can now give everything to you, Susie, without you giving anything back to me, because everything I need in Christ I already have. That is the only thing that can save relationships. That is the only thing that can bring about rest. That is the only thing that can actually empower us to enjoy the things that we do. So many of the reasons we don't enjoy the things that we do is because we need those things we're pursuing or those things we're doing to give us something in return, to validate us, to make us feel valuable and worthy and all of those things. But when we don't need that kind of stuff from whatever it is we're pursuing, it actually makes pursuing those things enjoyable.
Mm, so good. And really, if you look at it, that really becomes a form of idolatry. If we really are looking to those things as a source to draw life from versus a gift to be stewarded, that's a significant issue, isn't it?
It is, and that's exactly right. That's what it is. It's idolatry. Idolatry is not just worshiping some wooden statue in a far-off land somewhere. Idolatry is oftentimes taking the good gifts that God gives us and turning them into ultimate sources of meaning, which means that our spouse can become an idol, our children can become an idol, our work can become an idol, our dreams and ambitions can become an idol, because we're needing these things to validate us. We're needing these things to come through for us so that we can feel justified and valuable and those sorts of things. And so that's really what an idol is. It's not just what they told us it was. Idols are, you know, and John Calvin said, our hearts are idol-making factories. We're constantly taking the good things that God has given us to enjoy and turning them into ultimate objects of worship, ultimate objects of meaning. We need these things to come through for us in order for us to feel good about ourselves and all of that stuff. And, you know, the gospel sets us free from that.
And really, this is a freedom he paid such a high price for. And it is amazing how people oppose it because they want to strive in their own efforts. I've got a question from a listener before we take a break here. Andrew called in. He said, I've noticed that my wife struggles with working with others because of a sense of comparison and perfection with her coworkers. How can I support/encourage her to rest in God's grace? You know, how often does perfectionism drive this thing, our striving? And what do you say to Andrew?
Yeah, boy, that's tough. I mean, I've realized that when I was 22 years old, I set out to change the world. And now I'm 42 years old, and I've lived long enough and suffered enough and failed enough to realize that I can't change my wife, I can't change my kids, I can't change my church, much less the world. Thank God for Jesus. So on the one hand, I think it's important for Andrew to be able to remind his wife that, listen, all of the love that you need and long for, you already have because of what Jesus has done for you. And therefore, you've been set free from the sort of competitive comparison that seems to enslave you from time to time. I mean, I would say preach the gospel to her, give her good news, remind her that it is finished, and then trust God to do the work in her that only God can do, and be patient. You know, I mean, sometimes the fruit of grace always comes in the future, and it takes a long time for our stubborn, hard hearts to get it. I'm still getting it. And I think I will until the day that I die. And I think just being gracious toward her may be the best way for her to finally get grace and see it.
Good, good word. Talking to Tully and Javidjan, we've got one more segment. If you got a question about grace, again, you can call anonymously if you want, but we welcome your questions. We'd love to stand with you today. 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484, or email Susie@myfaithradio.com. We're with Tully and Javidjan in a moment. You know, know, if you need a grace awakening, you should check out some of Tullian's books. I'm talking to Tullian Chavijan today. We're kind of drawing from his book. It's a devotional. It is finished. 365 Days of Good News. And in one of the chapters, you write about Tim Tebow, this man of God who could not win no matter how hard he tried. Give us a little context of Tim Tebow's story and what we can learn from just what happened with him.
Yeah, there was, he's, you know, an amazing guy in so many ways. I just always felt bad for him, you know. I mean, there was so much pressure on him. He won the Heisman Trophy a couple years back. You know, most people didn't think he would be a good NFL quarterback because of the style of football he played in college and how that's not easily adaptable in the NFL. And he had pressure on him from the world of sports. He had pressure on him from the Christian community because he's such an outspoken Christian. And I just felt like here was a guy who didn't really have the freedom to fail. And when he did, when his NFL career did not pan out the way he wanted it to, you know, he was just criticized and laughed at and, you know, all of those things. And it becomes such a wonderful, terrible example of, you know, the pressure that most of us live under in much smaller ways and in a lot less visible ways. Just, you know, this idea that we feel the pressure to make something of ourselves. We feel the pressure to impress. We feel the pressure to justify our existence by what we do and by who we can become and who we're connected to and how our kids turn out and what people think of us and all of those things. And that's precisely the pressure that makes us weary and heavy laden. And that's precisely why Jesus invites us to come to him, the one who came not to abolish the law, but to fulfill it on our behalf, so that we could experience the rest that we so desperately long for. I mean, there is just, you know, and I say this in my book, Jesus Plus Nothing Equals Everything, that because Jesus succeeded for me, I'm free to fail. Because Jesus won for me, I'm free to lose. Because Jesus was extraordinary for me, I'm free to be ordinary. So that my identity, who I really am, has absolutely nothing to do with me. Who I really am has everything to do with Jesus' accomplishment, not mine. His performance, not mine. His obedience, not mine. He has forever done everything the Father commanded, so that he fulfilled all of God's holy conditions in order that our relationship to God could be wholly unconditional. And that is good news. I mean, that is good news in a game-changing sense. And I don't know what I would do without it. I mean, I've been a Christian now for 21 years, and this is my functional lifeline. I mean, I am a desperate, bad man. And if this isn't true, I am screwed, because I'm like, there's just no, there's just no other news that gets me out of bed in the morning. If what got me out of bed in the morning was my own resume of righteousness, I'd stay in bed. And so the fact that, you know, Jesus has come and done for me what I could never do for myself, and he has given to me what I could never give to myself, is just, it makes my heart melt with love and gratitude and appreciation for him. And it fixes my eyes on him, the author and finisher of our faith. And I'm just so grateful.
And that you just made such an important point, just by the way you're living it out, that the person who really continually has a deepening understanding of grace, to me, the fruit that comes out of that is humility and gratitude. And on the flip side, I mean, remember part of the the Tim Tebow story is once he got out of football, he started to be a speaker, and he was invited to speak somewhere. And so apparently it was not a denomination that certain Christians thought he should speak to, and they came against him, so he decided not to, and then other people came against him, and the guy just couldn't win. And don't you think, Tullian, that we can't give something that we don't possess? I mean, when you look at this day and age of Christians, and I bring it up on the show once in a while because I'm so burdened by it, it needs to stop, but this bullying nature, I mean, people are so frantic, and they're correcting him, and they're correcting everybody else. Where is that coming from? Is that coming from a fear, a pride? What is that?
You know, yeah, I mean, I tell the people at Coral Ridge regularly that if they grew up in church like I did, we understood Christianity primarily in terms of transformation. Christianity, the foundation of the Christian faith is transformation. It transforms me. It transforms the world. Transformation is the end game. And instead of Christianity being primarily about substitution, which is Jesus-focused, Christianity as transformation is me-focused. And the way that plays out in our interpersonal relationships is when we see Christianity primarily in terms of transformation, we try to fix people rather than simply love them. When we see Christianity primarily in terms of substitution, we love people rather than fix them. And I think that's an important distinction because, you know, we cannot ever please everybody. In fact, Paul says in Galatians, it's something amazing. He says, I'm not trying to please man. And then he says, I'm not even trying to please God. And you're like, whoa, wait, hold on a second. I thought this whole thing was about pleasing God. And his whole point there is God's already pleased with me because of Jesus. I mean, it's one thing to be enslaved to the people around you going, I have to get their approval. But it's even more enslaving to live your life thinking, I've got to get God's approval. I have to live a life that God approves of. When the fact of the matter is we are already approved by God because of what Jesus has done. And it's believing that that actually brings pleasure to God because we walk by faith and not by sight.
So what advice do you have to someone who gets caught in the chaos of all of that, the back and forth, correcting and judging and rant and rage? Do you know what I'm saying? Where someone's like feels like they're in the middle of people just kind of coming down on them. What can they do so they can find that safe place in Jesus?
Yeah, I would say find new friends.
Yeah. You heard it here.
I mean, literally, who wants to be around? And I've had friends like this in the past. But, you know, I mean, who wants to be around someone who's always trying to fix them?
Yeah.
No one does. I mean, we want to be around people who love us unconditionally, who love us when we least deserve it. And what's ironic is, as I think back on my childhood, my dad was the embodiment of grace to me. He was so loving and so amazingly gracious. In fact, it was his embodiment of grace that God used to draw me back home. You know, when I was in my early 20s. And but I mean, he had so many different examples of him loving me when I least deserved it. And when that happens, anybody who's listening can testify to the fact that when they've done something stupid or when they've done something bad or they've done something to hurt someone or a group of people, when they get forgiveness and grace rather than, you know, correction and basically the law being laid down and criticism, something comes alive inside of us where, and I've said this before where, you know, if I'm in a bad mood and I'm not being sweet to my wife and she reciprocates my lack of sweetness with sweetness, that doesn't make me want to be more unsweet. It makes me feel bad for being unsweet, and it makes me want to be sweet.
Yeah.
And so grace actually produces what the law demands. And I think, you know, when we're around people who are always criticizing us and that sort of thing, I think what it reveals is that these people actually believe that the law has the ability to accomplish what only the gospel can. And I don't know about you, but I am most inspired to change when I'm surrounded by people who aren't trying to change me.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. You've said so many amazing things today. And one last line from your book, you say, grace is very wooing. May we just embrace that grace and may we just exude that grace. That's really what's going to win the day. Tully, and I know you're such a busy guy. It means so much to me that you would sit out in your car and talk to us. I can't even tell you. We have just about.
Thank you, Susie.
Yes. Well, I just want to pray for you because we just have a moment before we have to go out. So, Lord, I want to thank you for my brother Tully and bless his family and his ministry and help us, God. Help us. Give us an understanding to walk in this and the faith to embrace it. And may we never lose sight of that awe and the wonder of what you've done and what you did when you said it is finished. We love you, Lord, in your name. Amen. God bless you, Pastor. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Susie.
Always good to talk with you. You've been listening to Live the Promise. I'm Susie Larson. You can find a podcast of today's show up on our website at myfaithradio.com. If you have a friend who needs a grace reminder, send them today's show. Click of a button, you can send it out. Hey, I'll meet you back here next time. Embrace grace. God's already sold on the idea of you. See you later.